Welcome back. We are now going to start the post-lunch session. This is working session number 2. This particular session is titled Roundtable with Political Journalist. This will be chaired by Ms. Sabha Naqvi. Sabha Naqvi is the political editor of Outlook, one of India's leading news magazine, and writes on politics, governance and current affairs. She has traveled extensively across India and she has covered elections in the country, particularly in the states of Uttar Pradesh, Bihar and Gujarat. Beyond her role as a political reporter and analyst, she follows issues of identity and culture. She is the author of the book Good Faith, published in the year 2013. We have got three speakers in this particular panel. Sankar Raghuraman, associate editor of the Times of India. Nilanjan Mukhopadhyay, to my left. He presents the long-running weekly show A Page from History on the Lok Sabha TV. And very shortly, will be joined by Paran Jay Guha Thakurta. Over to Sabha Naqvi.
Hello, I'm absolutely... Hello, everybody. I'm delighted to be here in the midst of what is turning out to be a very exciting general election. When I began covering politics over 2 decades ago, then I came in at a time when things were changing in India. There was the Ram Mandir movement and there was Mandal. So that was such a defining time to enter, even though I was just a low sub-editor at that time. I didn't get a chance to do the big stories. But one absorbed, one realized that we were watching things which were changing the social profile of the country, which was changing the political parties. And they were exciting times to just be in journalism. And then I spent a lot of time covering subsequently mainstream parties, the Congress, the BJP, and just done all of them at some point or the other. And after a long time as a journalist, I'm excited. I may not be happy with what appears to be coming, but it's exciting times as what is happening in India. And we have to make sense of it. There is, of course, the growth of the Bharatiya Janata Party, which is being projected as headed to be the single largest party, perhaps even touching 200. We have a lot of regional parties who do not get the attention that they deserve in the national media. And we have the emergence of a new force like AAP, which, even though it has been criticized a lot, we cannot take away the fact that newcomers, you know, people who are not from the traditional political class, have entered a political game. And they've sort of registered vote shares in quite a lot of places. And this is the situation right now. It's an exciting time. And yet, the thing that confronts all of us journalists is, when we apply our minds to it, is that how is the arithmetic of the next government going to be made? I mean, it's a mathematical proposition for which I have no answers. I used to always flunk maths anyway. So I'm going to turn to Shankar, who is wonderful with crunching numbers, and who I'm going to ask him to first give us some clarity on, is there any hope for anything new? Is anything going to add up, or we're just going to remain confused? And what is your take on what is coming?
I'll start by saying that Sabha is exaggerating my comfort with numbers. But I'll also refer to something Sabha said, that the general assumption is that the BJP is on upswing and could possibly even touch 200 on its own. I'll take you back about 10 years, almost exactly 10 years. February 2004. At that point, Paranjay, who will be joining us shortly, and me, we just completed our book on coalition politics. And the publisher was Sage. At that time, Mr. Tejeshwar Singh was still around. Among the things we said in the book at that point of time was that don't write off the Congress yet, and don't be surprised if the BJP and the Congress put together either fall below the halfway mark in the Lok Sabha or just about cross the halfway mark. Now, the prevailing wisdom at that point for those who were around on the eve of the 2004 general elections was that the NDA was coming to power comfortably. The Congress was simply not in the race. What was being debated as now was what figure will the BJP touch? Will the BJP on its own cross 200? Will the NDA on its own be well over 250? Most people were convinced that 250 was entirely on the cards, perhaps even 300 for the NDA. So Tejeshwar Singh looked at us and he said, you're going to release this book in February. The elections are going to be held in April. You'll be proved wrong very, very soon if what you're saying doesn't happen. Do you really want to take the chance? The book will die before it even is born. So we said, well, we are just putting our mouth there. You're putting your money in it. So in all fairness, that call should be yours. And I remain eternally grateful to Tejeshwar that he said, no, if you are willing to take that chance, I'm willing to take it. And so we went ahead and we published the book. The point, why am I being autobiographical here? The point is that just because everybody in the media says something is happening, it's not necessarily true that it's happening. It's an odd thing for a media person to say, but it is borne out by our experience. I'm sure Sabha has seen similar situations over her career where the media is completely unanimous in what's going to happen and quite the contrary happens. So I would be very, very wary of, at this stage, suggesting that the BJP is doing fantastically well. And there are reasons for this skepticism. Let's not forget that there are large parts of the country where the BJP simply does not exist as an electoral force. If you take the four southern states, Kerala, they've never won a Lok Sabha seat. Tamil Nadu, they have when they were in alliance with the ADMK, but they've never won. They've never had even an MLA in the assembly. Andhra, at the best of times, they think about two seats, four seats. So it's really only Karnataka in the south where the BJP is in play. In the other three states, they're just simply not in play. If you move to the east, and in that I'm including the northeast, in almost the entire northeast barring Assam, the BJP is virtually non-existent. It's only in Assam that they have some presence, but even there, they are either runner-up or third place. And Assam has only 14 seats, so if you're second or third there, how much are you getting? Bengal, again, at the best of times, they can hope for two. Odisha, similarly, you go to the extreme north, Kashmir Valley, clearly the BJP can't win. So the BJP, while it claims to be a national party like the Congress, the truth is it does not quite have the national spread that the Congress has. So there are something like 200 seats in which it's simply not in the contest. So if you're talking about the BJP getting 200 seats on its own, you're really saying it's going to win something like 60% of all the seats it contests. When was the last time any party in India did that? Probably in 1984.
We just had the assembly elections where they did very well. Their strike rate in their own areas.
Remember, but that's their own areas. That's their own areas. And more importantly, these are areas which have been traditionally Congress versus BJP. So if there is an anti-Congress mood, there is only one party which can gain from that mood in all these areas. And the interesting point there is that the only state in which a third party emerged among these, the third party actually did fantastically well. For a new entrant to get 28 seats in the Delhi Assembly was quite remarkable. And that indicates the point I'm trying to make, that just because the Congress is looking like it's down and out, don't assume that that automatically means the BJP is doing fabulously well. These elections, these assembly elections are not an indicator of the national mood because, as I said, they are in areas where it's Congress versus BJP. What happens when there are other participants in the race? That is the real question. That is where the election is going to be settled. This election is going to be won or lost in areas where it is not Congress versus BJP. And that is the bulk of India's seats. UP is not Congress versus BJP. Bihar is not Congress versus BJP. Apart from all the other states where I mentioned where the BJP simply doesn't exist. So more than half the Lok Sabha seats are in states where it is not a Congress versus BJP fight. Which is why I would say it is much too early to be sort of, you know, writing profiles of our next Prime Minister. I think there's a long way to go before we get to that state. They want me to...
No, I'll interrupt you and then I'll turn to... Shankar, I wish you're right and I hope you're right, but I have just travelled in... I've just come from Tamil Nadu last week, mm-hmm. and UP is my home state, so I get blow-by-blow accounts from families scattered from central to the eastern UP. And I have travelled there 3 times this year. The BJP is on a very big growth thing in UP. What is happening, and this is my take on it, it's curious to my mind because I live in Delhi, is in Uttar Pradesh, it's the Narendra Modi factor which is working something like the Kejriwal factor did in Delhi. There's this new guy, because the traditional BJP there is pretty washed up in terms of leadership. You've had the same Kalraj Mishra, Lalji Tandon, and they were sort of Kalyan Singh. They were pretty much a finished force. But so he was having that impact. But I have not travelled there since December, you know, after the Delhi results, and I'm told some people hopefully tell me that AAP is also taking away some of the vote share in Uttar Pradesh, but they were on a big growth trajectory, you know, UP. And knowing, having spent far too many years covering them in a situation where there's also communalization, there is bound to be further growth for them, which has happened in Uttar Pradesh. So that's going to be an area where they're going to do well. They're going to be the single largest party, according to me, in Uttar Pradesh.
Quite likely.
You know, and...
But Sabha, don't forget that even when they got close to 60 seats in UP...
58.
Yeah.
I mean... Yeah.
When they got close to 60 seats in UP, they still did not get beyond 182 national...
Yeah, fair enough. No, I'm just talking to you about specifics. Because we talked about... you talked about this election being fought in states where it's not Congress versus BJP. Similarly, in Tamil Nadu, where I went last week and I've done a story, certainly the lady is going to do very well because the arithmetic is in her favor and there's nothing really going against her, and the others have not got their alliances in order, as you know. Though again, the people in the metros talk about a growth in a sort of BJP-like voters, which then is dismissed as upper caste people who would like the BJP. So I don't think we should be that complacent. We have seen surprises. And especially about the Hindi heartland, I think the Modi is going
to... I do believe that the BJP...
In this case, they're going to break new terrain over there. Now, the extent to which, we can't say. So, I'm going to bring Niranjan in, who's actually written a book on Modi, you know, and so he can tell us what you think is happening, Niranjan.
Well, first of all, thanks to Professor Badrul Alam of Jamia, for you know, inviting all of us to have this wonderful session. Shankar, who is the only panelist, and Sabha, who is chairing this meeting, thanks, Tan. I would like to begin by giving a very broad understanding of the way I look at elections and the emerging 2014 scenario. Quite often we say that India is basically a land of serial elections. We are talking about election 2014. We have not even recovered from this dramatic upsurge of the AAP in the assembly elections. We will not even get over with the Lok Sabha elections, when elections are due in Maharashtra, they're due in Haryana, where somebody who till very lately or even now is very much part of the seminar room could be a potential chief minister. We really do not know. So we are really in for very interesting and dramatic times. I was listening to what Shankar and Sabha were saying. Journalists are best at doing post-election analysis. I feel very uncomfortable about this, getting they're going to win this, they're going to win so many number of seats. Look, that time, the maximum that they won. You know, we are all friends, you know, these are all nice little calculations which we make, but quite often, or not my experience is that we have always faltered. Yes, as a class, as a group of professionals, we all failed to see that what was coming in 2004, Sanjay is here, 2002, let me go back a bit further to the assembly elections in Gujarat, when the entire media, the entire so-called the secular lobby had written off the possibility of the BJP doing fairly well in Gujarat. If I remember correctly, the CSDS was possibly the only opinion poll which actually put its neck out and said that they're going to sweep the elections. I still remember that detailed survey and its findings which are published in the Frontline. I've used it on numerous occasions. I keep on referring back to it. There have been times when CSDS surveys, which Sanjay has been part of, has been correct. There have been times when they have not been absolutely as corrected. But that is their expertise. That is what they want to work on. I would not want to start looking at, you know, evaluating questions that where is which party going to perform and where. Rather, I would like to look at that what is this election going to determine, what does it mean for me. As somebody who has written about elections for a long period of time, this is going to be probably the 9th election about which I will either write directly or be indirectly involved with, starting from 1984 onwards. In the last 20 years, there has been the general consensus that India does not have one single general elections, but always there is an aggregate of 543 elections. Is this trend going to continue, or is there going to be a break in this? Are we going to then make a break and then return to what used to be called earlier the two-party system, where the Congress represented one pole and the non-Congress parties represented the other pole? The only possible change which can happen is that instead of the Congress, you could have a new party which could become this single largest pole around which the entire politics operates, which acts as the fulcrum of Indian politics. Whether that single party is going to be the BJP or whether it is going to be an amalgam of parties led by the AAP is yet to be seen. I do not want to hazard a guess. That is simply not my. But the first thing that I am going to look at is whether this is going to be a single issue, single individual, single topic election, or whether it is going to be an election which is dominated by as many local factors as there are constituencies. The recent assembly elections in Delhi, Rajasthan, Madhya Pradesh, Chhattisgarh, to a great extent, showed that there is a possibility. I'm saying there is a possibility, there is not a certainty, that yes, we might move away from this aggregate of elections to a single election happening, where there is a single factor which runs across the state, across the country. It's a very interesting point which Sabha made, you know, about how the BJP, she feels in her field surveys when she's gone to the UP. She feels that the BJP is doing fairly well. In fact, you know, that is one of the points which I had made the note of. I talk from a perspective of somebody who has actually looked at the emergence of the Sangh Parivar over the last quarter of a century or maybe even more. I've very consistently tried to track the evolution of this party from the time when there were just 2 members in Lok Sabha. In this election, to my mind, the BJP is not an old party. It is coming into the electoral arena as a completely new party, as a party which is taking along the old, along with this, a huge, system, an entire system, which is completely new to the party, which is being introduced by Narendra Modi, in the form that he is bringing in a certain, techno-savvy bunch of young, middle-aged professionals who are coming in and energizing the entire campaign, giving it the kind of ideological thrust which he thinks is best for India. It's a different thing that I, for one, do not think that that is good for India. But anyway, that's a secondary thing. So we have a situation where we have an old party in the garb of a new party, which is the BJP, and we have a completely new party, which is the AAP, which is coming. Faced with that, the Congress has been trying to play catch up by also saying that we are also a new party through the kind of intervention which Rahul Gandhi has initiated. 15 parliamentary seats where they're going to have presidential style primaries to select constituencies. You know, this entire talk of power, you know, being a poison, not showing an overt keenness to become prime minister, as indicative of a new tendency within the Congress. So we have a situation where there's a certain amount of newness in this particular election. It is very difficult to say at this stage that how long this particular newness is going to continue. What is going to be the performance after the verdict comes out, we'll be able to look at it. But this is something which I would like to track. The second thing which I would like to track along in this particular election. The third thing which I would like to track in this entire debate is this so-called debate over, where here I start getting into a slightly specific, individual specific point, this Modi vis-a-vis moderation debate. To the best of my knowledge, the entire country, especially in the media, we have agonized over the fact since the middle of 2012. When will Modi begin to moderate his stand? We have kept on saying that the moment the assembly elections are declared, Modi will begin moderating. When it did not happen, we said that the moment the verdict from Gujarat assembly is out, he will start moderating his stand. After the verdict came out, when it did not happen, we said the moment he is appointed as the head of the campaign committee, suddenly some new campaign committee, an extra constitutional post came up in the BJP, it was expected that he is going to begin a process of moderation. And then prime ministerial nominee, and then once the campaign begins. The point is that there are a large number of people who feel that Modi has always been a moderate, that he has consistently moderated himself, his positions in the last several years. And there is another group of people which feel that Modi is not capable of moderation. There are a large number of people, you know, I am also of the similar view, that him going to Gorakhpur and saying that Mr. Mulayam Singh Yadav, to make Uttar Pradesh, a state like Gujarat, you have to have a chest of 56 inches, 56 inches ki chhati. Now, why do you require it? What did the 56 inches ki chhati do in Gujarat? Definitely, it did not make those highways. It did not do several other things which has been claimed as the development policy. It did something else. So, to make every other state a Gujarat, you require a 56 inches ki chhati. I don't think anybody can be more polarizing than something like this. Yet there is this veneer of moderation which a large part of India which has been waiting for various signals to come from Modi, so that somehow or the other they can become part of the political forces being let into motion by Modi, because they are A, upset with the Congress and its style of governance, and secondly because they have not seen any other national alternative. Would there be a decline in this particular shift to the BJP from the Congress which was happening? The rise of the Aam Aadmi Party is possibly the biggest danger to the BJP's emergence as a party which can very comfortably form a government with Narendra Modi as Prime Minister. Because as I think Sabha was saying and Shankar was also saying, the urban seats, you know, where the Congress did remarkably well in 2009, which was traditionally a BJP stronghold, where it did not do very well, because of the kind of disillusionment which has set in about the Congress in the last few years, these seats would have naturally gone, expected to have gone to the BJP. But with the rise of the AAP in Delhi, and it likely to have, possibly, I'm not yet, definitely not saying that it is going to have, but would there be a possibility of this having a cascading effect in other urban majority, urban dominated seats in other parts of the state, and thereby upset the plans of the BJP? Whether or not this happens, but the point is that every seat that the Aam Aadmi Party wins is actually a seat less from the final tally of the BJP. This is something which we need to understand, because if the AAP would not have been there, in all probability that seat would have gone to, or would that constituency would have been more tilted towards the BJP.
Nilanjan, if I can interrupt, there's a lot of analysis that the seats are being taken from the Congress, and in Uttar Pradesh, Bahujan Samaj Party is worried that the seats are going to be taken from them. Just to interrupt, so it's not just the BJP. I mean, in future projections, as a stronger party, So it's across the board, you know, the damage, just a little. In Uttar Pradesh, very clearly, she made a speech the other day, she talked about Aam Aadmi Party. So it's it would not be accurate, in my view, to say that only the BJP is being challenged by AAP. In fact, there is an entirely alternative discourse saying that...
I'm not sure that specifically talking in terms of the BSP. I'm not sure about the kind of seats which the BSP held or places where they stronghold. To what extent would the Aam Aadmi Party be able to damage the BSP? I'm not very sure about that. But definitely it is something which needs to be seen. We definitely look at, maybe what you write is, you know, we can see that instead of looking just insularly at the damage which the AAP is going to do to the BJP, it's possible to look at the other regional parties also which it is going to do. Going back to a little bit of more elaboration on what I was talking about Modi and the moderation part of it. I have argued for some time that Modi is India's first national mainstream anti-Nehruvian leader who has completely broken away from the cast of what a political leader was supposed to be, the basic parameters under which he was supposed to, you know, display a certain amount of commitment. I've said repeatedly that the emergence of Narendra Modi into the position that he is possibly the biggest thing that has happened within the politics of the Sangh Parivar after the demolition of the Babri Masjid. I've argued that the emergence of Narendra Modi is possibly more significant than Atal Bihari Vajpayee becoming the Prime Minister and NDA ruling for 6 years. Because the NDA government, despite being in power and despite definitely being a BJP government, did not challenge the frontiers of a Nehruvian framework as the way Narendra Modi has done consistently since 2002. He is he's definitely questioned the notion of secularism as has been accepted, or the debate has gone on. His basic commitment to democratic values and democratic styles of functioning has been well documented, and I do not think that this is the right platform to actually get into a debate. His commitment to, again, welfare state is questionable. We all know that what has been his basic understanding of an entitlement-based politics, where he looks at growth as something not necessarily to continue with distribution, where distribution is just about incidental to growth, not integral to growth. There are a few of the things which is there, which possibly makes, to my mind, to look at in the next 2014, to what extent would the kind of political forces which Narendra Modi is representing, the kind of ideas that he's trying to bring in on the table of being a strong, vibrant, decisive leader, to what extent it is going to get an appeal. We'll be able to possibly draw a conclusion once the verdict comes out. But these are a few of the things which I would like to see over the next few months, just barely less than 100 days left for the elections. So I think that is it. I'll take a break now and then we'll...
We have Paranjoy Guha Thakurda with us, who I'm sure has lots of things to say. Paranjoy, briefly, we talked about, you've heard a bit of Nilanjan. We briefly mentioned Aam Aadmi Party, but I have a question for you actually, what I want to know. Is the arithmetic ever going to add up? I mean, seriously.
Good question. Excellent question.
For anyone.
Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, my apologies, I've walked in very late. One always underestimates the traffic at Ashram. But I hope I will not be repeating the points my colleagues have already made. I just thought I'll step back a little bit. And if you look at certain trends which were evident in the last five general elections, 96, 98, 99, 2004, 2009. And then we can say whether in 2014 we're going to see very significant changes from the past trend. What were those trends? The voter turnout was roughly 60%, 58 to 60%, so say 60%. So let's assume that the voter turnout, it may be a little more, a little less, but it'll be somewhere around 60%. Second point. The two largest political parties in the country, the Congress and the Bharatiya Janata Party, without their allies, without their coalition partners, together got roughly half the vote. A little more, a little less. Maximum 26%, down to 22.5%. Each party. The BJP's maximum vote share was about 26% in 1998-99, came down to 22.5% in 2009. So the two largest political parties in the country together got up roughly half the vote. You can say, put it differently and say half the people who voted in India didn't vote for either the Congress or the BJP, but voted for some other political party. Out of 28 states in India, it's only in 6 states. It used to be 7. Delhi is now not there. In only 6 states is the political battle between the Congress and the BJP. And these are Uttarakhand, Himachal Pradesh, Gujarat, Madhya Pradesh, and Chhattisgarh.
Rajasthan.
And Rajasthan, I beg your pardon. Yes, 6. So,
Goa.
Yes, okay, Goa. I'm not including maybe some of the smaller states like Arunachal Pradesh, Jharkhand. But in all the other states, there's at least one important player other than the Congress and the BJP. And certain states, you can argue that both the Congress and the BJP are in the fringes of the polity. And these are, say, Tamil Nadu and Bengal. So this is the other point that I wanted to make. The third point I wanted to make, in close to 200 out of the 543 Lok Sabha constituencies, the BJP doesn't have a presence. This includes 160 parliamentary constituencies in the 5 states of Kerala with 20 seats, Andhra Pradesh with 42, Tamil Nadu with 40. Tamil Nadu plus Pondicherry 40, Bengal 42, and Jammu and Kashmir. Okay. So, in other words, the BJP will really be fighting its battle in roughly 350 odd seats. Okay. Now, the second point, and maybe I'm sort of treading into this hazardous game of trying to predict outcomes. The BJP won 2 seats in 1984, and then it peaked at 182 in 1998 and 99, and then it came down to 137. In 2009, it was 116. Congress won more than 200 MPs in 2009 for the first time since 1991. Okay, just facts I'm stating now. Then we of course know that we have a lot of uncertainty because we have a first past the post, winner takes all kind of system. And just to give you an example of how uncertain it can be, between 2004 and 2009, the Congress vote share all India went up by just around 2%, but it gained 61 seats. The BJP's vote share came down by around 3.5%, but it lost only 21 seats. Okay, last point I wanted to make, and that is that if you look at the last 5 Lok Sabhas, roughly 40% of the members of parliament were not re-elected. Roughly 40%. So that's what you might describe as anti-incumbency sentiments. So the question that would now arise is, how far are we going to see a change in 2014 from the trends that were very, very apparent in the past, in the last 5 general elections? And I mean, here we can have a discussion, Shankar, Sabha, you can say. I think if the BJP believes that it can get 200 seats on its own, or somewhere between 190 and 200 seats on its own, which is off the record what BJP spokesperson said, informally, officially, of course, for instance, I asked Mr. Yashwant Sinha, how many out of these 350 seats are you going to get? He said, we're going to get 300. I mean, so officially you ask Rajnath Singh, how many seats are you going to get in Uttar Pradesh? We'll get 50 seats out of 80, at least 50 seats. So, I mean, I'm going beyond what officially the spokesperson of these parties say. Informally, you tell them, the BJP's calculation of getting somewhere in the region of 200, between 180 and 200, is contingent on the BJP performing very well in particular states. What are these? Uttar Pradesh is the most important one because the BJP only has 10 out of 80 at present. Rajasthan, it hopes to do very well because it has only 4 out of 25 at present. Bihar, it hopes to do very well because it's only got 12 out of 40. There are 3 other states where the BJP also hopes to do reasonably well. One is Gujarat, where it has now 9, Congress has 9 MPs. It had 11 in 2009. So BJP hopes to get at least 4 or 5 out of those seats. In Madhya Pradesh also, the BJP hopes to do much better because the Congress has 12 members of parliament. So it hopes to get a few more, maybe 4 or 5 more. In Maharashtra too, the BJP has 16. I stand corrected. The BJP has 16 out of 29 in Madhya Pradesh. And the Congress has 12 out of 29. In Maharashtra, the BJP has 9 out of 48. And it hopes to do also substantially well. Privately, the BJP concedes that it may not do well in Karnataka, despite Mr. Yediyurappa coming in. And that is that it right now in Karnataka, the BJP is 19 out of 28. Privately, I've at least heard one BJP spokesperson from Karnataka saying that we'll be lucky if we get 10 or 12. That's what he said. He may be completely not representative of, or he may not have the feel the mood or the pulse of the people. Also, Chhattisgarh, I believe it will be a little difficult for the BJP to get 10 out of 11 MPs out of Chhattisgarh. So then, if you assume that the BJP is going to gain in some of these states, the arithmetic is quite simple. If you do a back of the envelope kind of calculation, you are coming to a figure somewhere between 180 and 190. Even if you assume that the BJP is going to get 40 out of 80 in Uttar Pradesh and 20 out of 40 in Bihar, these are very, very important states. So the only point I want to make is that if past trends are an indication, and I'm not even getting into the Aam Aadmi Party at this point of time, it would not be easy for Mr. Narendra Modi as the head of the BJP to become the next Prime Minister of India. That's my analysis at this juncture. Now the parties that are expected to do better than before include Ms. Jayalalitha's party, AIADMK. The AIADMK currently only has out of 40 Tamil Nadu and Pondicherry, AIADMK only has 9. And with the tie-up with the communist parties, now they are saying we'll sweep the polls. I mean, they are claiming, of course. Ms. Mamata Banerjee has 19 out of 42 in Bengal. She also hopes to perform well because she hopes to gain some seats at the expense of the left. And she also hopes to gain some seats at the expense of the Congress. Congress has 6. I think none of us really know how many YSR Congress will get in Andhra Pradesh, but everybody expects them to do reasonably well. And Andhra Pradesh is a large state. Andhra Pradesh has 42 MPs. That's a big question mark. The left expects to do very well in Kerala because it has only 4 out of 20. So the left hopes to gain in Kerala. So this is the big scenario that one is seeing. So your guess could be as good as mine about what happens in, I think it might still be the 13th of May 2014, could very well be, because it was the 13th of May 2004 and the 13th of May 2009. So maybe if we wait to the 13th of May, we know. All I can say is that the India or the Indian politics filled with surprises. Surely Mr. Vajpayee never thought his first government would last for 13 days. Surely Mr. H.D. Devegowda never thought he'd become the Prime Minister of India. Surely Mr. Vajpayee never thought on the 17th of April 1999 that he would lose a vote, his government would lose a vote of confidence by one vote out of 543.
Thank you so much, Parinder. That's very sort of thoroughly you've put some points before us. You know, I had mentioned before you came here that I'd been to Tamil Nadu just last week, and I'd done a story, and at this point she looks poised to sweep. And again, a state without any BJP, but as a journalist who's always making predictions that often go wrong, I expect the BJP to do very well in Uttar Pradesh. So, there are two questions actually we've not been able to address, and one of them is the question of, in a post-election scenario, can parties actually afford to come ahead and support Mr. Modi? Presuming he will be short, which at the very least he'll be substantially short of a majority. That is one. But since we are in Delhi, and since this is run by AAP, we have limited time. I think perhaps we should talk a little bit about Aam Aadmi Party as a force, because just my clear thought, one is that I find AAP got so much publicity and now it's criticized in such an extraordinary way. By the right wing, of course, whom they present now a challenge. As long as they were useful to them, it was fine. And very interestingly, by the left, which expects them to take positions on everything, like a party document, you know. This is our stated position on this, this is our stated position on that. A very sort of left, you know, as that, who are you, how dare you do this? You have to think about this posture, this position. And my own feeling is that they're a completely new force. They're untried. They've had a remarkable breakthrough in Indian politics. And I just thought that I'll move on and get some thoughts on AAP over here, before, you know, and if we have
if
time.
I can, yeah, please. I'll just make 2 minutes. First, a disclaimer. I'm on the committee on the media policy of the Aam Aadmi Party.
I didn't know that, Parinjoy.
Yes, okay. And I'm also on the committee on the Natural Resources Committee where I've attended.
So are you a member of?
I'm not a member of. I must clarify, I'm not a member of the Aam Aadmi Party.
Okay, I didn't realize.
Having said that, I think it's in all fairness, the two points I find very significant about.
This is Hum Aapke Hain Kaun moment.
Two things I found very significant about the amazing performance of the Aam Aadmi Party, and very honestly, I was as surprised as everybody else when Yogendra Yadav said that we are going to get 33%. I said, come on, Yogendra, I mean, come on, relax, kind of thing. And then I could never have imagined that they get very close to 30%, very honestly. I also never thought that the BJP's vote share would come down in Delhi by almost 2%. I never thought that Sheila Dixit could get defeated by 25,000 votes. Having said that, I think to me the most significant aspect of the rise of the Aam Aadmi Party in Delhi is that I think the Aam Aadmi Party has reclaimed an old tradition of Indian politics. Namely that you can run a political party and you can fund and finance an election campaign with voluntary donations, small donations obtained from large numbers of people. Instead of big bagfuls of money from a few cronies of yours. So I think the Congress used to raise money like this before independence, after independence. The Communists used to raise money like this. The RSS used to raise money like this. So it's a very old tradition in Indian politics that you run a party and you run a campaign with small donations from large numbers. So to me, that's very significant. To me, also that's significant that what seems to have happened in Delhi is that the rise of the Aam Aadmi Party in Delhi has also to some extent signified a decline of sorts or a reduction in the significance of identity politics. I mean, you assume that there are vote banks, people vote on the basis of their community, their religion, their caste and so on and so forth. Some of us have believed that, you know, the influence of identity politics in India is coming down or diminishing somewhat. And to me, that's the other significant aspect.
I mean, you know, that can be a very controversial discussion, but I won't go there, so because we could argue for hours about that. But Shankar, just to get you in on AAP, and then Nilanjan, just some quick, so that we can also tackle the last thing. Can anyone afford to support the BJP post? You know, that sort of. So, let's get there also. So just quickly, if we can just have some thoughts.
See, on AAP, as I said earlier, to me, the significance of AAP in AAP's performance in Delhi really is how the Aam Aadmi in Delhi reacted to the presence of a third alternative in a state where there never had been a third alternative. And why, I mean, if you look at it, as Nilanjan said, journalists are essentially good at explaining something that has already happened, pretty bad at trying to predict what will happen. So, since this has already happened, I think we are on safer ground here.
You know, we spend half our time predicting what is happening, but it's okay, carry on.
So, I think the appeal of AAP, people assume that it is largely based on its anti-corruption plan. To my mind, that is one part of its appeal. To me, the greater appeal of AAP is the feeling that they are genuinely concerned about people's issues and are willing to listen to people. To me, that is their real appeal. And there is a feeling that the political class has no idea what people want, is not bothered about what people want, and is out to fulfill its own agenda. Now, if I'm reading that right, if I'm reading the public mood right on this, that they do not like this kind of politics, then Mr. Modi is not a very attractive proposition. Mr. Modi is the classic example of a leader who knows everything, doesn't have to be told what's to be done. He knows what's to be done and gets it done. That's his own appeal. He has this firm leader who knows exactly what he wants and will get it done. My perception is that there is a growing feeling that please ask us what we want. Don't just tell us what we want. Don't just tell us that you know what needs to be done and get it done. We also have some ideas on what needs to be done. And that is where AAP is succeeding. Which is why, for instance, the manner they went about forming the government everybody assumed that there would be widespread disenchantment with AAP if they formed the government, having promised not to tie up with either Congress or the BJP. The fact that they did it by seeking a public referendum, I think, worked for them. Because people said, okay, so this is not about whether you want power or not, it's about whether we want you to form a government or not. And they did get public support for forming the government. My suspicion is if they had not done that referendum and had sought and had agreed to seek Congress support, they would have been widely condemned. Everybody would have been said ki ye to ye bhi waise hi hai jaise baki hai, satta ki lalach in. So that appeal to me is the key factor working for AAP. Now, will it work to the same extent across the country? I am not so sure. My perception is that in Delhi they had, let's not forget, even the Anna Hazare movement was largely concentrated in Delhi. Yes, there were some ripples in other parts, perhaps more in Bombay than anywhere else, but it was largely focused in Delhi. So there was already a groundswell in Delhi which AAP was able to capitalize upon. I don't think a similar groundswell exists elsewhere. My suspicion is they will not do very much anywhere else. But again,
yeah,
now we are getting into the prediction.
Yeah. Well, in Tamil Nadu, I checked it out and I found that the Kodam Kulam protesters, they're getting onto their platform.
So they're taking
on a lot of, but not with the general, the new element there is actually Modi.
Yeah.
I mean, it would be the small fringe number would be wanting.
Just a word of caution there. Most Tamils that you would speak to would tend to be Tambrams. Tamil Brahmins.
I'm very cautious about Tamil.
You have traditionally been very soft on the BJP.
Yeah, I agree.
And they constitute 2% of the population of the state. So they're extremely vocal.
Yeah.
Despite all the talk about how they've been disenfranchised and marginalized, and so, they still control large parts of the economy of that state. So they are a very vocal lot, and they can mislead you into believing that there's a huge
Brahmins. Brahmins haven't misled me for a long time. I'm from Uttar Pradesh. Rest assured, I can handle it. Nilanjan, just very quickly on AAP, and then I think we'll have very limited time.
I also have a small little disclaimer.
Sorry.
Among various pieces which I have spoken about in the last 1 month, I have written and spoken against AAP. I'm going to speak not from that position. I've also
but you've got to make it short, now, because we really have something else to discuss and we have to open up the debate, and I have very strict instructions.
I think the rise of AAP is probably the most dramatic thing that has happened in Indian politics for a long time. I do not think that there has been any social movement of this intensity in a very localized manner conducted over a much shorter period of time. Anything that has happened which can be remotely said to have been seen in India after, on a much bigger scale, after the Ram Janmabhoomi of the VHP. The Mandal, the act, the protests of the, on the Mandal Commission was a protest, not a movement really. So possibly, yes, the anti-corruption movement of Anna Hazare, which was later on took the shape of Aam Aadmi Party, the biggest thing that has happened. I have two basic problems with the Aam Aadmi Party, where my disagreement. But I think, you know, that the corruption issue has been reduced and presented in an apolitical manner. And the second thing which I feel very uncomfortable about is the anti-political thrust of the entire Aam Aadmi Party's genesis. That is where the problem is, that everyone is a chore. We are the only ones who are the holier than thou. This entire moralizing posture is something which is actually troublesome. This is where what Shankar was saying, that probably because they went in for the referendum, they did not get the flag. I have not really thought about it, something which you have really given an idea to. Think that whether they could have been in, you know, been really put in the dock for having joined the government. There is something very significant which we have to recall, you know, not giving the exact back and forth. But Yogendra Yadav, in the process of that government formation, did say that we are in the business of politics, and we are also in the business of creating a buzz about what we are doing. So the very fact that, yes, there is nothing wrong in being in politics, and definitely nothing wrong in staking a claim. So which means that, is there some kind of a dichotomy between the genesis of the Aam Aadmi Party and the strategy which is being adopted? Second thing which I think all of us would try to look at it, it's still too early, we do not have had good reports coming to see the kind of motivations which led to these 28 MLAs or the others who are applying to become candidates of the Aam Aadmi Party, how are they different, any different from the aspirants or MLAs or legislators of other political parties? Are they also coming into and entering politics for the same sake, which is basically to have a share of the power and see it as a form of social climbing? These are few things which has to be seen, but yes, Aam Aadmi Party's rise and emergence is possibly one of the biggest, has the possibility of being one of the biggest factors in this particular election.
A very brief intervention. You know, whereas I agree with what Nilanjan said about how the significance of the rise of the Aam Aadmi Party, where I don't entirely agree with him. You see, when it was the India Against Corruption movement headed by Anna Hazare, it was not just an anti-corruption movement. It had a single point agenda, the Lokpal. It wasn't at that point of point talking about, you know, sort of weakening the nexus between business and politics, doing away, you know, having clean elections or election funding. It wasn't talking about natural resources and the way natural resources were being misallocated and undervalued. So it was really a movement with a single point agenda. As we subsequently saw, the fact that Anna Hazare, Kiran Bedi and a whole lot of people are no longer part of the Aam Aadmi Party, I think they have evolved. And as a political party, and you are right, late 2012, there were not just a single agenda. I mean, when some of us asked Arvind Kejriwal, he had that mythical analogy about the fish and Arjun's arrow. But I think they have evolved, and as a political party, they have to have a number of, they can't focus on one issue. Look at the struggles, look at the difficulties they're having in putting together a coherent agenda on economic policy, on foreign policy. They're still struggling. They haven't been able to do it so far. The other point, I think, the real dilemma before the Aam Aadmi Party is that you want to expand very quickly, rapidly. You want to, the momentum that you've gathered, you want to capitalize on it, build on it. Then you're going to get a whole bunch of people, opportunists and worse, who would probably end up tarnishing your party. So this is the big dilemma which I don't think they'll be able to easily resolve.
You know, as a media person, in a election which is, Narendra Modi is also a creation of the media, the hype that's gone around him, that's built him up, he's going to be PM, he's the leader, he's the man. I can just say that he was sort of being presented as the face of India's imagination. For me, significantly for this election, Arvind Kejriwal, because he was charismatic and he was so different, he appeared suddenly plonk in the middle of this discourse. As soon as they won four assemblies very, very decisively, they stopped being covered. We were all busy covering Kejriwal. So he certainly stole Narendra Modi's thunder, because not only was he a charismatic figure, he was the opposite of him. This guy with a muffler going in a metro for his swearing in, which I went and saw, and then his speech in the Delhi Assembly. He was great at delivery, and he was completely and there was Modi, arrogant all the time. And I know this, being a journalist, having covered the BJP for years, there was consultancy sessions on whether Modi should tone down his arrogance. And I think some effort has been made for him to sound a little more modest. So the real significance of AAP, you know, we can keep splitting hairs and saying they should have done this, we should have done that. In the middle of a general election, which people had said belonged to one man in terms of imagination. I'm not talking about arithmetic here. Naturally, AAP cannot challenge the arithmetic of the Bharatiya Janata Party. Suddenly, the image, that face has been challenged. There is another face out there, which can be presented as a challenge in the heartland areas, not in the south. And I think that's a significant thing that they've achieved in the middle of this election. Now, I know we are running out of time, so should we sort of open the floor?
Yes.
Or just sort of open up? Okay.
Yeah, respected chairperson, I think all the presentations were good in place in terms of the journalistic viewpoint that you have really got in. Nevertheless, there are important paradigms we have to really question. For example, when you say Narendra Modi, you know, into the democratic values, when you say that the welfare state, and last week only we see the data of, you know, another, you know, planning commission, different sort in a state, that, you know, new data has been revealing. that is the welfare state, and also important is that strong nationalist question Nairobian ideas. We have to really also see the ground reality. For example, the election in Himachal Pradesh, where Narendra Modi visited, how he impressed, and ultimately the Sukram factor on corruption did not work, and virtually they voted for Sukram only, that yeah, this is the party, this is the person. Then there are also other factors, like for example Delhi election. I mean, NDTV virtually announced to the extent that, you know, BJP is in power, and all of a sudden everything turned about. You know, you have an AAP party, you have a mandate of the people. So here the question really comes that we have to really probe in the fifth state, that is the new media. I mean, how new media has catapulted the geometry of all the political parties, which no one has ever thought of, whether it is Twitter, whether it is other medias, so that is, or blogosphere for alternative media. So related to this very question, new media is youth. Herein we have to really question that how the youth trend has been. I mean, BJP has not, I mean, it virtually failed to capitalize. So that is also important, because unless we see the youth, where it goes. For example, a father is a diehard BJP activist, RSS activist, but the youth is going to vote for Aam Aadmi Party. So this is a new analysis of how psychology within the families and homes is working, and that is also the reflection on politics. That is number one. Number two, on the context of how the new media can go otherwise. For example, you predicted in UP, Eastern and Central, how they are dominating, but nevertheless, there may be counter-argument that how some leaders have, you know, imaged, brought images of Afghanistan, and then it was revealed to the people, so maybe people go otherwise also, because they know the reality objectively. So in all these paradigms, when we are talking of one party, we have to really think in terms of the regional politics, regional parties. I mean, Narendra Modi as a bandwagon on the national scale, how it is going to work against Rahul Gandhi or Arvind Kejriwal, it is a big question mark for 2014, because ultimately it is the regional parties again which are going to function, and I think I will have references from all of you. Thanks.
Anyone would like to take this? Karunjal?
The new media matters. We shouldn't overestimate the importance of the new media. There's a huge digital divide in India. These statistics are imperfect or incomplete, but what we have indicates that barely one-fifth of India has used the internet even once. What matters perhaps more is the mobile phone. Today, out of we have a population of 1.2 billion people, there are 900 million SIM cards or subscriber identity modules, and roughly 700 million people with mobile handsets. So it's important. But once again, one, in my opinion, when you go outside urban areas, we should also realize the reality of India, that 4 out of 5 people in this country still haven't used the internet even once. Though yes, today we have 7 out of 10 Indians with a mobile phone. That's the first point. Youth, yes, of course, the youth matters. We've added about possibly 120 million odd voters between 2009 and 2014. That would be the addition to the electorate. And yes, this age group between 18 and 23, yes, their voting preferences, whether they'll go with who their parents voted for or not, is indeed very important. I agree with you. And I completely agree with you, the regional political parties are going to make a huge difference. I think that at least perhaps a half a dozen political formations or parties which could get somewhere in the region of between 30 and 40 seats, and they're going to call the shots, and that only not includes the three eminent spinsters, Jaya, Mamata,
Maya. You're very careful
Maya.
How you talk about women these days.
No, Jaya.
You refer to nobody as spinsters.
You don't refer to them, okay.
No. You say
single women who run important political parties, Jaya, Mamata, Maya. And we have YSR, we don't know how well YSR will do. The left, as I was arguing, they might become weak in Bengal but gain in Kerala. So there were 25 at present. And of course, we don't really know how the Samajwadi Party will perform, or the Biju Janata Dal will perform, or Nitish Kumar's party. So, I mean, these are important small, quote-unquote, regional parties are going to be very, very important. We don't know how the Janata Dal United would do, whether it will become significantly weaker from 18 out of 40 at present, or remain where it is, or become even stronger. So I think they're going to matter a lot. And I could even argue that even if the BJP gets close to 200, but if it has to depend on the support of these quote-unquote regional parties, there would be a question mark on who would head the NDA, a likely NDA type of government. Shankar?
I agree as far as the new media point is concerned. In fact, I would go a step further and say the role of the media in determining electoral outcomes is hugely exaggerated. If the media was really that decisive in determining outcomes, it would not get its predictions wrong as often as it does. Quite clearly, we don't have as much of an influence as we like to believe we have. As for the youth, I would suggest that we tend to think of them as a homogeneous lot. I don't see any reason why the youth should be any more homogeneous than any other age group. So the youth, like their older counterparts, are divided along all kinds of lines, from community to income groups to regional affinities and so on and so forth. So I mean, much is made of the fact that there's such a huge youth vote bank, but I don't see why we make such a big deal out of it, because it's not as if they're all going one way. As for the regional parties, again, all the predictions which talk about BJP getting close to 200 also simultaneously talk about the Congress falling below 100.
Right.
So what, whichever way you look at it, it all adds up to saying that at least about 240, 250 seats are going to be with the regional parties. So clearly they are going to remain important players. Whether they have a decisive role or not, I don't know. But I would disagree with Paranjoy on how much of a role they'll have in determining whether Modi becomes PM or not. If the BJP does get 180-190 seats, I don't think anybody can stop Modi from becoming PM. I do not think that, I mean, past experience tells us that a lot of parties which would apparently not be able to accept Modi have perfectly comfortably accepted him. If you remember, even the Telugu Desam Party, which threatened to bring down the Vajpayee government if the Gujarat government wasn't dismissed, ultimately played ball and stuck around.
Let's look at the history of all the parties who supported the BJP. Since you tell me that I'll get misguided by Brahmins of Tamil Nadu, they've all told me that every time DMK says they got out of power after that in the assembly. Anna DMK has also learned a lesson. It's not about Muslims. 15% Muslim and Christian vote. They have an assembly election 2 years from the Lok Sabha. That's one problem. TDP, we know where they went for so long. Mamata Banerjee may have supported Atal Bihari Vajpayee at one point, but her politics is very different now. She'll also be confronting an assembly election 2 years ends with, I think, an electorate which is 35% Muslim?
No. The official figure according to 2011 census is about 23% of West Bengal's population is Muslim.
Okay.
But many, the actual proportion could be higher because some believe that declared.
My point is the regional players ultimately playing for assemblies. So don't go by what happened with the Vajpayee regime
Look
at the way those assembly state players fared after they supported the BJP government.
Look at the DMK was part of the NDA till the 2004 elections, and then was part of the UPA in the 2004 government. So it didn't fare badly at all.
No, except
the state.
No.
They lost 2001
and they have this general body assembly. One of the analyses that came up is that they lost that particular election because of being with the BJP at that point.
No, but the truth is that they swept in 2004 and 2009. So it didn't really cost them as much as we might
think. The real mark, you know, for whether Modi becomes Prime Minister or not would be that whether he's able to cross the mark which was set up by Vajpayee in
182.
Yeah. Would 182 be crossed by Modi? Anything less than that, his chances are diminishing. Mm-hmm. Anything more than that, his chances are increasing. If it stays between 182 to 200, he's kind of hedged in by allies. If it begins to cross 200, then it means that he starts getting dominant on the others. If he crosses, for heaven's sake, you know, to to 20, for instance. It means that then the allies have no other option but to just be rubber stamped.
I not only agree with everything that Nilanjan is saying, it's easier for you to calculate the regional parties who have never aligned with the BJP. Then look at the regional parties who have aligned.
Okay.
The ones who haven't aligned with the BJP are the Samajwadi Party, the left, the Rashtriya Janata Dal. Let me ask you one thing.
Can Mamata Banerjee, there are two women who are going to do very well.
No, Mamata can't.
Mamata and Jayalalitha. Both of them will have assembly elections coming up. Do you think
BJP does suddenly, surprisingly very well in West Bengal?
We're talking about Lok Sabha. We're talking about Lok. Do you think Mamata can now do what she did then?
My own hunch is that Mamata is very, very conscious at this particular point of time of roughly 1/4 of West Bengal's electorate, which is Muslim. I also do believe that the actual proportion of Muslims in Bengal is a little higher than 23%, because there are a number of Muslims who may not have declared themselves as Muslim when the census happens. But I do believe that Mamata Banerjee would be an important player. And it might help her, you know, not to take a position at this point of time. I mean, look at Jayalalitha, for instance. She was perceived to be very close to Narendra Modi. She went on two occasions when Narendra Modi was sworn in as Chief Minister, Jayalalitha was present. But when Narendra Modi comes to Chennai, she's not available for him, and she then ends up aligning with the communists.
Her people say that she chose to congratulate him till he became campaign committee chief. The minute he became the PM candidate, because Madam herself is a PM candidate, Madam chose not to congratulate him.
But if he does,
very clearly,
it's quite like so.
The problem with Modi is not his communalism. The problem with Modi is that he's a rival.
He's a rival now.
The moment she ceases to be a rival, she'll have no problem supporting him.
So can we take some more ladies. Questions, please, of some ladies first? So any lady who has a hand up there at the back, yeah. So.
I'd like to talk about Uttar Pradesh. Yes. Very supportive and very positive about BJP in UP.
I'm not supportive or positive.
The statement I just personally. So,
she was being pessimistic.
I'm pessimistic, but I'm realistic.
You said that, BJP is doing very well in UP and leading there.
Yeah,
that is pessimistic. So I would like to ask, like, if we come to UP, specifically Eastern UP, then Modi gave speech in Gorakhpur. There is a Goriknath Mandir which had founders of Hindu Mahasabha and all. So they are a very strong force of Hindutva and all. And Yogi Adityanath, a well-known personality, he is not supporting Modi, a figure like Modi as a PM candidate. So BJP there also, inside they are not supporting each other, right? Even Yogi is not dependent only on the Hindu ones, right? The area of Goriknath, there are Muslim bastis around it, and any communal violence take place, but not a single Muslim of that Goriknath area is harmed, right? And all of them vote for Yogi. So the minority votes counts a lot. And Modi made a speech in Gorakhpur. He talked about Dalit, he talked about scheduled caste, scheduled tribes. Not a single time he pronounced like minority, right? So the image of Modi, right, and the BJP, the grounds of BJP, I think that it may cause a political chaos scenario, right? Because the insiders are also against, and the hyping of the personality of Modi and all. So my question is that minority vote banks always counts, right, whether it is Samajwadi or anything like that. But Modi now declared as a prime ministerial candidate, why he is not talking about minority? Because it is a part of, like, we are part of this whole country, nation, like minority. And not a single time in his speech he talked about minorities. So I will like your comments on will it lead to political chaos, like this very much I get
what you're asking.
Yes.
First of all, Mr. Modi would like the minority vote to be scattered. It would not like it to be united between one party, because in a first-past-the-post system, you like to have your opponents' votes divided up. Currently, the situation in UP is that the minority vote is divided. There is a lot of confusion between the Samajwadi Party and the Bahujan Samaj Party, and the Congress is a declining force except in a few places. In this election, you'll have a lot of confusion on that front, and at this point, BJP's own assessment is that the votes are divided, which works to their advantage. About the point that you're making about, so there is no question of Mr. Modi really making a pitch. His best bet is to neutralize the level of mobilization that there can be against him, is not to actually really get Muslim votes in areas like UP. He has a very fertile ground right now, because UP has also seen communal rioting. And just a little insight into what happened, how it spilled over into Uttar Pradesh. A very senior BJP leader told me that actually in the Delhi election result, they lost more of the middle class support than is being shown to the Aam Aadmi Party. But they were able to make up for it, because in the ring of the Jats and Gujars around Delhi, Aam Aadmi Party apparently made one statement about the Muzaffarnagar violence. And the Jats and Gujar villages, which were divided between, there were some were going for the Aam Aadmi Party, they overwhelmingly went and voted for the Bahujan Samaj Party in Delhi. This was a BJP strategy guy who was telling us. So the point he was trying to make is that the middle class vote, even more of it was lost than appears to be lost in the analysis, post-poll analysis. So Uttar Pradesh is ripe for a very complicated set of reasons. There's no question of Mr. Modi really expecting Muslims to vote for him. And I'm surprised what you're saying about perhaps out of his own control over a region. Aditya Nath is one of the most communal, blatantly communal, Muslim-hating traditions in Uttar Pradesh itself.
He also,
Aditya Nath is not liked by many of the BJP leaders, because he seemed to be a little too extreme in his public pronouncements. You know, just to add a point to what Sabha was saying, Muslims account for 1 out of 7 Indians, okay, roughly 14% of India's population. In Gujarat, this proportion is 9. It's close to a fourth in states like Bengal and Kerala. It's close to a fifth in states like Uttar Pradesh and Bihar. I'm excluding Jammu and Kashmir from this calculation. Very few expect the Muslims to vote really for the BJP. Or I think Mr. Modi also doesn't expect, despite the few token, quote-unquote, topi walas in his public meetings. The big question that you have, and this is really the question that Sabha flagged, is when you have three-cornered, four-cornered contests, which you are expecting in Uttar Pradesh and in Bihar, what happens to the Muslim vote? Do they get consolidated behind what is perceived to be the most likely non-BJP candidate, whether it be SP, BSP or Congress, or whether it gets fragmented? And Mr. Modi hopes that it will get fragmented. That would consolidate the Hindu vote. I mean, that's his
character. I'd just like to add a bit, you know, this very specific thing, that how does Modi look at Muslims? This is something in one of those very few conversations which I could have with him in the course of doing the book. I asked him very specifically, when we're talking in the context of Gujarat, you know, there's this huge 9% vote. Out of your 6 crore Gujaratis, almost 50 lakhs are Muslims. What do you do with them? Are they going to be part of your electoral calculations? So he said, they're fine, you know, they're fine to be Muslims, they can keep their religiosity in their particular home, but when they come into the public terrain, in the public domain, basically, I don't expect them to come as with a religious identity, but you know, as part of just about anybody and everyone, he specifically said that main hamesha bolta hu ki 6 crore Gujarati. Main kabhi nahi bolta hu ki 5.5 crore Gujarati. So which means that everybody is part of my praja. So I guess that is, everybody is part of my praja, but I will not recognize them as part of a Muslim praja. You understand what I mean? The basic discourse in this country is that any ruler in this country has constitutional responsibility to take care and see that the minorities of these countries are taken forward along with the majority. That is not part of this scheme of things.
So, just two brief points. One, I think when Mr. Modi makes conciliatory noises towards the Muslim community, he is not really addressing the Muslim community. It is not that he believes that because of that the Muslims will vote for him. He is addressing the Hindu who is uncomfortable with his communal.
Yes, absolutely, I agree. Yeah.
That is the section he is trying to address. He doesn't for a moment believe that that's going to cause Muslims to vote.
Absolutely.
Second point, the Muslims are constantly referred to as tactical voters. You know, and there was in some sense a reference there, not without that phrase being used. Now it has always appeared to me a very strange terminology, because if they are the only community which votes tactically and everybody else votes non-tactically, how come they've never got their due proportion of legislators in any? I mean, even in states where they are in huge numbers,
absolutely,
in UP, you won't get 20% of UP's legislators being Muslims. So, I mean, it must be amazingly bad tactical voting.
Thanks, you've been wanting to ask, please go ahead.
Ma'am, I have a question. First of all, I'd like to thank all the people who are present in the GS and the panelists, of course. Ma'am, the question that I'd like to ask, that talking about Modi's role in 2000 to Gujarat riots, one thing I remember that today I think the media has forgotten, if you revisit the history, there was a time in 2012, particularly from February to May, all the reputed newspapers and magazines have talked about the amicus curiae Rajiv Ramachandran's report, but it has been said that Modi can be prosecuted. And today what I surprisingly see, because I'm not convinced with his ideas, and what he has surprisingly see that when the clean sheet has been given recently in the court, there is a much media glare and attention in it. So if you see on a historical trajectory, that how the, do you think this media reporting, I do agree with you that media reporting does to a certain extent affect the political outcome. There was a time in 2012 when the media said that Modi should be prosecuted. In fact, Tehelka gave it that prosecute Modi. And this was a report, if you see the May 2012 of the Hindu report, and you will understand this thing. Today the media has gone on a different transition. Do you think that it will be able to change the people's perception about Modi? Because what many think is that, and any scholars or legal scholars, that SID investigation was shoddy. And I can refer to one person's blog, I think you know his name. This person, Sanjeev Shablok, who wrote a book on breaking free of Nehru, and the only Indian IS officer to lecture in the World Bank of 1981 batch, he has even written in his blog that he completely thinks that SIT's investigation is shoddy and wax. So how much do you think that when do we see this transition in media? Media said in 2012, prosecute this person, talked about amicus curiae Rajiv Ramachandran's report, and today the media is saying they're giving the clean sheet. I understand. So do you think it will change the people's perception?
No, do you think the media is changing? I would tell you
No, I'm not saying the media is changing.
I think the real, what's actually happening, I mean, if you don't mind my saying it, is the media is shallow. Media has also done a lot of reporting in exposing Modi and all of that. It's the bureaucracy which is changing. So for some months now, you talk to people in government, they're not willing to listen to them. It's the bureaucracy. You just had the Home Secretary go and join the BJP. You have a police commissioner, police chief of Bombay go and join the BJP. The real problems are coming, inquiries are being subverted within the system.
A former army chief almost joined the BJP.
Don't blame the media, because we're always out there and Shankar is blaming us all the time anyway. So, I'll speak up in defense. So, please.
I have a question to all the four journalists. Since you're known for assumptions and presumptions, maybe you'll answer. Do you think that if Modi finds his numbers dwindling, He's behaved like a child who wants that rattle. Mujhe wo khilona chahiye, mujhe wo prime ministership chahiye. So he's behaved that way. Do you think that he will apologize to the nation, particularly to the Muslim community or the minority community in particular, to get his numbers from 180, 190, which your assumption is, to 272?
He's already done it.
He's
already written a blog. I mean, okay, let's.
No, that's not a problem.
His blog does not say. His blog is very careful. He says that I was under pain because I was attacked.
Yeah.
He never says I was under pain because people under my rule were killed.
Had he said that, he would not have equated the.
I'll reply to our question. Yes, this is something which I said.
Really, sorry.
Modi is not a religious crusader. He is in this business not for changing the character of India, but is here to grab power. If he has to say sorry, or if he has to do anything else to become Prime Minister, I, as a person who has interacted somewhat with him, will say that he'll definitely do it.
Yes.
Shankar,
what is your opinion?
My feeling is that it is crucial to Modi that he is not seen as
till the elections.
In any way apologetic for what happened in
till the elections. After that?
After that is possible. But electorally it's important for him
till then he will not. Till then he will not.
I don't know. Have anything to apologize.
You know, very honestly, I don't know. But what I found also significant is that Mr. Rahul Gandhi had to be reminded by Arnab Goswami that Manmohan Singh had apologized in for the anti-Sikh riots in November 84. So I thought he would actually bring it out on his own. I thought he would also remind Mr. when he was talking about the difference between 1984 and 2002. He would talk about the role of people like Maya Kodnani and all, but well, Rahul Gandhi is Rahul Gandhi.
Any more questions? So we have, yeah, from there, please.
As you said that there is
I'm not saying they're playing a positive role. I'm not saying it's a positive role. I'm saying they're going to do well. That doesn't mean positive. Please don't misunderstand me.
And my friend, don't put Singh between Narendra and Modi. Now he'll get very upset with you. Damodar Das. Narendra Bhai Damodar Das Modi.
No. I'm saying they're going to do well electorally because it's already communalized, but please, I'm not saying it's a positive role.
He has been doing well, and in UP, he has been a very, very influential factor, and even more than Abdul Bihari Vajpayee now. So, if you think that if he, after 2002, as he said, that I had to opt for development agenda, being a political necessity, and now those innate tendencies which he had to curb back in 2002. As part of the political agenda, if he becomes prime minister, do you think that this thing will come out? And it will be again a threat for that BJP if you think that he's playing a very positive role.
I mean, you know, look, there are two, three things. Supposing he becomes Prime Minister and he's comfortably there, and he's not, presuming this is the imaginary space, two, three things will happen. The curriculum changes which took place under the former regime, history was rewritten. There are these cases about Hindu terror cases, they'll all vanish. That's one of the big concerns of the RSS, which is why they're batting for them. Just two, three things. So, I mean, you know, we don't even have the time to get into it. And I see another hand raised there. So, but.
Sorry, you know, we spent the entire morning talking about the app and we didn't mention the BJP at all. So I just wanted to suggest two things. One, maybe all of you would like to comment on the recent kind of television tamasha or whatever, you know, trotting out figures like Zafar Sureshwala and Salman Khan and, you know, what that's saying about Modi's willingness to make overtures or how these are going wrong or whether they're effective and so on. And secondly, somehow really, you know, it might make sense since two people have had that completely erroneous impression of what you were saying. You were saying the BJP will do well in
Uttar Pradesh.
And that's somehow been interpreted as your enthusiasm for the BJP. So, why don't you clarify that because that's a very important point.
You know, it's actually very revealing because as a journalist, does that sort of condemn us to saying that people we don't like will always do badly? Because we don't like them, is that the only way we'll be understood? Because no, because when you're a political journalist, your job is to be as objective as you can be and to use your experience to understand what is happening on the ground. So when I say, just let me clarify this about the BJP and Uttar Pradesh. One, Mr. Modi as a person is having an effect there like Mr. Kejriwal had in Delhi. It is a bit away from the traditional old BJP. There is a Modi factor there. He's untested, he's untried. There is a lot of very quick disenchantment with Mr. Akhilesh Yadav, before that Mayawati. And that is one factor. Secondly, there is a communally charged situation in UP which is ripe for them. Thirdly, UP has a lot of cluster of towns all over, and the urban vote is looking for something new. So for those reasons, and the fact that I happen to be, my family happens to be from UP, I'm familiar with that state, I don't think I've covered UP, any other place as much as UP and Bihar. I know that the BJP is going to do well in UP. I would not give a figure at this point. But that does not mean that I support the project of the BJP. That's my assessment as a political journalist. So just to clarify that.
You know, I think just to add to what Sabha was saying. See, Uttar Pradesh, if it was an independent country, would have been the world's sixth most populous nation after China, India, the United States, Indonesia and Brazil. So it's very difficult, you know, to, I mean, Uttar Pradesh is such a huge, I mean, one out of six Indians live in that state. What we had in 2009, the Congress surprised everybody with its performance. I mean, everybody, including the Congress, was surprised because they got 22 out of 80. But so did the Samajwadi Party. And the Bahujan Samaj Party got 21. The BJP got 10. And the Ajit Singh's party, the Rashtriya Lok Dal, got 4. And Kalyan Singh as an independent got 1. You don't have to be a great political analyst to believe that if the Congress weakens, as it is expected to, and even if the Samajwadi Party weakens, then the beneficiaries are bound to be the BJP and to also the Bahujan Samaj Party. So I think there is a certain inevitability of what is likely to happen. What we don't know is how much can the BJP get? Will the BJP get 30? Will the BJP get 40? Will the BJP get 50? And how will the votes get fragmented? That's really a difficult, prediction to make.
You know, it's been so fascinating. We can go on and on because half the things we haven't been able to address. But I have just got a nudge. And thank you so much, Professor Badrul Islam, for having all of us here. I wish we could have expanded longer. And as journalists, we can all endlessly go on predicting. And okay, very quick. Short question, not a commentary.
Yes,
okay, yeah.
I'm not speaking about a personal thing, don't take it as personal. I'm speaking about a media activism. Especially today, most of the media is working about the ethics. What ethics is all about.
Okay.
Example, in some cases, judges as themselves as become the victims. And also, one more thing, even politicians are buying the media for their own goodwill. What is your opinion on that? Because I personally know one of the cabinet ministers is...
We're all very worried. In fact, Paranjoy has done a fantastic report on the whole media and all of this, but
he's part of the media policy group of Aam Aadmi Party.
And he's part of the,
I have a textbook on media ethics also, by the way.
So, but see, you should take him aside and ask him separately, but because we have to wind up now. Thank you so much. Thank you so much.
I would like to thank this particular panel, Sabha Nadvi, and also Nilanjan Mukhopadhyay, Paranjay Guha Thakurta, and Dr. Shankar Dabrahman. Thank you for
having me. Thank you so much.